white shoes.
What's the matter, Morty?
Moral, the string.
Can't you buy our whole dress?
Moral, the string.
Great gowns.
Moral,
beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed.
Moral,
no, it hasn't.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And welcome back to the Every Outfit podcast. This is our monthly rewatch episode. We are doing The Man, the Myth, the Viagra. And yes, this is the episode that Donald Trump has a cameo appearance in. So if that is upsetting to you, please stay for the episode because it actually is one of the best Sex and the City episodes. So many canon events happen.
Yeah, it's a truly great episode.
We chose this episode this week because Donald Trump has been sworn in as our 47th president. He was also our 45th president. This is probably the last time he will be sworn in as president because, as he said, there'll be no more elections after this.
I'm imagining him delivering that in the style of Leonardo DiCaprio in The Wolf of Wall Street.
So yes, we are going to talk about the inauguration. Again, I know people do not enjoy when we talk about politics, and I do understand it. People look to this podcast as a refuge from all the other bullshit. Does everything have to be political? And I'm sorry, but this was a pretty significant pop culture and fashion event. If you do not want to hear any of this and just want to go to the Sex and the City rewatch part, there will be a timestamp in the episode description to tell you where and how to do that. Are you guys still with us?
I've left.
No, Chelsea, come back. I'm not Kristen Davis. I can't do this alone. I need a co-host. Before we talk about the various events and outfits that happened during inauguration weekend and the inauguration itself, I have seen an online discourse about the fact that is even discussing this normalizing Trump?
Is discussing Trump normalizing Trump?
Yes. And I will say some of the coverage I've seen a little too normalizing of what's going on in the Trump administration, but I just feel like to ignore what is happening would be normalizing it even further.
Yeah, I agree with you. We have to be able to talk about things. We don't have to give breathless fashion coverage like Susie Menke's, but we'll get into that later.
Shall we start with the Village People?
You know, it's sad that they didn't perform at the actual inauguration, because I think this was kind of the most exciting thing that happened all week.
For our interests.
Yeah. Like, I get that it's weird for them to perform a song about gay cruising during the inauguration, but also, like, why not? It would make it more fun.
So this is something I've been wanting to discuss for a minute, and certainly after I watched the film The Apprentice, which is Trump has very gay interests. Now, please understand, Chelsea, I don't think that he himself is gay. However, I do feel like he has very gay-coded pop culture interests. Like, have you ever seen that quote where he talks about seeing Phantom of the Opera?
No.
He was riveted by it.
Who was it? When that chandelier falls, it's all over.
But I feel like his love of opera and the Village People.
Well, being too cultured is gay.
But I wonder if these kind of gay-coded interests come from the fact that his mentor and central male figure in his life was the closeted man Roy Cohn.
Yeah, it's all about the company you keep.
I know people were shitting on the Village People for taking this gig, but it's like, it's a paying gig.
Yeah, that's not like the Milwaukee Pride Parade or something.
Or some D-list cruise.
Yeah, it is really odd that a disco song about men fucking has become the anthem for a party that, like, only wants there to be two genders.
Do you think Trump knows what the song is about? Or do you think Eric and Don Jr. and even Barron are like, let him have this?
He definitely knows what the song is about, but somehow, despite these overtly homosexual themes, it just became like a wedding song.
My friend is getting married this summer, and she was like, we're not having that song on the wedding playlist.
Is Macho Man still okay, though?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, the fact that MAGA people love this song is truly bizarre.
There is some bittersweet joy that I do get out of it.
Yeah, of course, because it's at the very least interesting.
Speaking of interesting, Shall we get into Melania and Ivanka's outfits at the inauguration?
Sure. With Melania, on one hand, I do appreciate the fact that she is dressing outwardly evil. Like, this looks like this could be costuming from Dynasty or something. That's the most generous read that I can give.
So we're talking about her very large hat, designed by Eric Javits. And one thing about Melania, especially when she's in First Lady mode, is she loves an extreme hat, especially if it impairs her from kissing her husband.
Yeah, I did appreciate that aspect of the design, I suppose.
And then her outfit was by Adam Lips,
who's like a mediocre designer that I've never really cared about. Although there was really nothing wrong with the coat.
It was a fine coat.
Like, it was classic. I understand why she wore it. Obviously, this whole outfit would have made a lot more sense if she was outdoors, but they just didn't change the outfits to accommodate the new setting.
I don't know if you're on Twitter/X that much, but the equivalent of my For You page has become way more conservative. So all I saw last weekend were, I assume, MAGA people being like, this isn't normal to move things inside. This isn't just about the weather. Something's going on. And it's like, no, he's cold. Trump doesn't want to be cold and shivering outside.
I get it.
It's not even a metaphor, right? All of his followers, the people that got him elected, who paid tickets to see his inauguration, were quite literally, Chelsea, left out in the cold. While all of the billionaires and podcasters got to be cozy inside.
Well, they should know that he doesn't actually give a shit about them.
They'll never know, though. Anyway, Ivanka's outfit?
Yeah, I think she outdressed Melania. It did look like a costume from The Handmaid's Tale. That was an accurate read. And that was designed by Oscar de la Renta. I don't really know what the late Oscar de la Renta's politics were. He was an immigrant, so I like to think that he would be sympathetic to their plight. But that is a brand that has historically dressed a lot of Republican women. And by that, I mean had Republican clients. Like, the women that wear Oscar de la Renta gowns are old Upper East Side Republican ladies.
Yeah, so I suppose that wasn't that shocking.
Like, I don't think it's a huge glow down for the brand compared to other brands, just because I feel like that is their audience.
I feel like people really want us to talk about Lauren Sanchez, because people had a lot of thoughts about this look, and I assume people will think that we hated this look, but it's a white Alexander McQueen suit with a lace corset. This is how she dresses, guys. I don't know what to say.
I love that she just couldn't wear a white form-fitting suit and just leave it at that. Like, she had to have the girls out. And she upstaged literally everyone, including Melania.
You've made this point previously about people who are considered, quote, fashion victims on the red carpet, like Bjork wearing the swan dress at the Oscars. And I feel like this applies to Lauren Sanchez, where it's not like she fucked up on the way to wearing a modest outfit. This is her version of a conservative outfit.
And I see how it could be construed as inappropriate for an inauguration, but this is Donald Trump's inauguration. If anything, all the women there should have their tits out. You know what I mean? That's more on brand for him. Like, think of the Miss Universe pageant and all of that.
Yeah, this is an inauguration that the Paul brothers were invited, and they messed with podcaster and comedian Theo Von's chair, so he fell when he sat on it. This is the wrestling equivalent of a presidential inauguration.
Yeah. Also, it immediately reminded me of that Seinfeld episode where Jerry dates the woman that just wears a bra as a shirt.
That's right. And she enters Elaine's office wearing a bra and her blazer completely open.
So good. Also, Carrie Underwood performed. Wasn't the performance she wanted to give. Clearly, there were technical difficulties, which actually I felt bad for her. As someone that has been a victim of technical difficulties, I sympathize, but I haven't seen her in a minute, and she definitely has Mar-a-Lago face.
Ooh, can you define Mar-a-Lago face?
Fillers, Botox, tan. It's really bad lash extensions, like really thick, like long ones that look scary.
and an HD degree of makeup.
It's a contour for sure. But it's a lot about the lips, you know? It's like too much filler there.
All this reminded me of people were, I guess, shitting on Carrie Underwood for performing or disparaging her performance, which again, as two people who are plagued with technical issues, especially sound issues from time to time, she has our sympathy. But all this reminded me of was, I don't know, is this any worse than when Jennifer Lopez sang and then dovetailed into a version of Let's Get Loud?
I mean, yes, it was worse than that. Also, I'm surprised that people are surprised that she's a Republican. Like, do people think that just because they like Before He Cheats, that means her politics align or something?
This wasn't surprising. I will tell you what was slightly surprising was the fact that the Arnault family was at the inauguration. Bernard Arnault, the patriarch, Delphine, the daughter, and then I think the son that's married to Natalia Vodianova were all there for Trump's inauguration.
Gross. I mean, I've always been more of a caring girly anyway, so.
Although it was just the 20th anniversary of Donald Trump and Melania's wedding, there was a post about it, and I forgot that, of course, the Trump family does have deep ties to the Arnaults because John Galliano, when he was at Dior, designed Melania's wedding dress.
Which had its own Vogue cover, which came out before the actual wedding. Remember that?
Oh, that was crazy. By the way, a wedding that was attended by Bill and Hillary Clinton, okay?
At a certain point, it's not Democrat or Republican, it's just rich person.
Yes, as evidenced by Kim Kardashian posting, it was Melania's outfit, yeah. Even though she's besties with Ivanka. If I were Ivanka, I'd be like, what the fuck?
I know.
But yeah, I think a lot of these people, like Tim Cook, even Jeff Bezos, the Kardashians, these are all people who probably did vote for Kamala Harris, but they have no problem kissing the ring. Speaking of people that kiss the ring that I was a little surprised by, as we previously noted, the breathless fashion coverage specifically by Susie Mankies and Vanessa Friedman.
Yes, I found it bizarre. I understand Vanessa Friedman a little bit. Like, she should be reporting on the fashion for the New York Times. But yes, I found the tone of it to be a little gross.
It was weird because her coverage on her own social media did feel a little unnecessary. But then her New York Times article was like, I have thoughts on Melania's hat. It's like, okay.
Okay, Susie Mankies, though, has lost her mind. She posted about the outfit that Melania wore to the ball later that night, or the party, whatever it's called. And she wrote this caption, Bravo to Hervé Pierre. First of all, who the fuck is that? Whose dress for Melania struck that fine line between graceful and chic. First of all, I don't think there's a fine line between graceful and chic.
They seem to be on parallel tracks with each other.
Like, the fine line would be like, oh, it's a fine line between edginess and chicness or something. Like, I feel like the fine line should separate, like, disparate things.
I kept thinking that she was referring to Hervé Léger and that Hervé Léger's middle name was Pierre, only for me to then Google who the hell Hervé Pierre is, and it's Melania's stylist who's also a designer.
How is it not a character from Emily in Paris is what I want to know.
Maybe next season.
Look, it was not the worst thing she could have worn, but the choker was so bad. Like, the choker took it into a deeply unchic place for me.
Well, yeah, she always needs to bring her Eastern European touch to every outfit she wears.
Yeah, it didn't hit for me. And then obviously, like, all of these people were like, what the fuck, Susie Mankies? You've gone crazy. And she doubled down and did a second post with the illustration of the Hervé Pierre gown.
We know that in the world of news, getting an exclusive is the thing that you want. And I'm sure it's exactly the same in the fashion world. And it seems that Hervé Pierre sent Susie Mankies an exclusive note and sketch, but it's like, not like this, Susie Mankies. Do you need an exclusive?
I know. Also, Hervé Pierre, as you can imagine, was born in France. He is now an American. But I'm sorry, like, what's the point of wearing American designers if the designer has the most French ass sounding name I've ever heard?
I mean, other than Oscar de la Renta, they all abandoned American designers by the ball that evening because Ivanka wore a Givenchy dress that was, I can't even say heavily inspired. It's literally a direct ripoff of Audrey Hepburn's Givenchy dress from Sabrina.
Yes, but it's a lesser version with less embroidery. It reminds me of when they recreated that Dior gown for Natalie Portman, but it was just like a shittier version with less beadwork. It's like, if we are going to recreate these incredible archival pieces, we have to have the resources to actually recreate them.
Well, people were really beside themselves about this one. It was like, how could Ivanka, whose family's fascistic ways are reminiscent of the Nazi party, wear a dress famously worn by an actress who was part of the Dutch resistance in World War II and whose slim figure is because of the starvation she suffered under the Nazi regime? I don't think Ivanka thinks of herself as a Nazi, so there's that. I highly doubt she knows that about Audrey Hepburn's backstory. I think she saw the pretty dress from Sabrina and was like, I like that. That's classy.
Well, basic bitches have been aping Audrey Hepburn's style for 10,000 years. So it's not surprising in that regard. It is a big glow down for Givenchy, certainly. I mean, they've really lost their way in recent years. Sarah Burton is the new creative director, which is exciting, but I don't think she's responsible for this. I don't know who's responsible for this, but it's not What's-His-Face who just left.
No, and Givenchy is an LVMH brand.
Yes.
Which would explain why the Arnos were also there. It's just lazy and dumb, this kind of self-referential design stuff. And I can't believe I'm about to say this, but be like Melania and just wear a nice gown.
I don't know. Was that nice? Was the Hervé Pierre nice?
You know, Chell, it might not have been nice, but it did straddle the line between what and what? Classy and chic?
That fine line between graceful and chic.
Okay, so before we get into the episode in earnest, do we first want to discuss Donald Trump's ties to Sex and the City? Because it runs deeper than anyone would think.
Yes, Trump's ties to Sex and the City begin with the pilot episode.
Right, where Mr. Big is described as, you see that guy over there? He's the next Donald Trump, except he's younger and much better looking. I'm actually surprised that Donald Trump would even agree the following season to make a cameo because he is so prideful.
Yeah, they literally called him ugly and old.
But it was the pilot. Perhaps he wasn't aware that this was said about him. He just knew that it was a popular New York show.
He was a fan of the show, though. Because he makes the cameo in season two. And then after that point, he attended many of the premieres.
Look, he could have attended the season two premiere. I couldn't find a photo of that. But we know, because he was photographed at the season four premiere, the season six premiere. I guess even he knew season five, too depressing. And the premiere for the first and second film. If he's not a fan, Melania's certainly a fan and made him go to those premieres.
Yeah. Trump was the person who presented Cynthia Nixon with her Emmy. When was that?
In 2004.
Yes. He presented with Simon Cowell at a time when that was a cute pairing, right? The reality guys are presenting together.
Yes. We will play you the audio here. I just want to note that where this clip starts, Donald Trump cuts off clearly what was Simon Cowell's line.
The nominees for Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Comedy Series are
Kim Cattrall, Sex and the City. Kristen Davis, Sex and the City. Megan Mullally, Will and Grace. Cynthia Nixon, Sex and the City, of course. Doris Roberts, Everybody Loves Raymond.
Okay, and the Emmy goes to Cynthia Nixon, Sex and the City.
So Cynthia Nixon has publicly stated that she wishes someone else presented her with that Emmy. We asked her about this both of the times that we interviewed her.
Yeah, of course. I mean, how else is she supposed to answer that? Hey, do you regret Donald Trump giving you your Emmy? Yeah, if anyone else could have, I would have rathered that. I think this episode and him presenting Cynthia Nixon with her Emmy highlights the fact that previous to Obama's presidency, Donald Trump was a man that was primarily associated in a completely different context. He was a preeminent joke, but New York figure.
Yeah, it's crazy how I don't even associate him with New York anymore. I associate him with Florida because obviously there's a lot of people in New York that still support him, but the majority, no. The majority of New Yorkers aren't voting for him. He's not getting invited to do like SNL anymore.
All right, let's go way back in time to 1999 and let's finally discuss the episode, The Man, The Myth, The Viagra. Welcome back to those who skipped our intro.
So this episode starts, as always, with a Carrie voiceover. Once upon a second time around, in a mythical land between Carmine and Mulberry Streets, two mere mortals were having a wonderful time.
You know what? I believe this. Carrie and Big enter an Italian restaurant laughing. Big knows everyone in the restaurant. Big really seems like a great hang in this episode.
Mr. Big is practically the mayor of Little Italy in this episode. And he speaks fluent Italian.
Hot.
He's seen Mean Streets at least a dozen times.
Oh, God, yes.
So he introduces Carrie as his girlfriend for the first time ever to the random Italian man that works there.
The man who's a real gangster. Gangster, who you calling gangster? This was a real, like, post-Goodfellas, the beginning of The Sopranos, like, you know, not all Italian-Americans are a part of the mafia. But Mr. Big notes that it's just the first time that Carrie has heard him refer to her as his girlfriend.
I was happy for her, which really goes to show how low the bar is that we've set for Mr. Big.
Well, I wanted to see where we were in the season, and the episode before this is the chicken dance. So the last time we saw Carrie and Big was him walking out on her wedding speech and her being like, I don't know if I can be with you or be with a man who can't even stay until the end of the wedding, and then they have cake and walk off together. So Big is evidently a regular. Here's what we know about Mr. Big. Between the hole-in-the-wall Chinese place that he takes Carrie in season one and this hole-in-the-wall Italian place, he's the original Eater New York. Like, he knows the hot spots.
And he also apparently can sing?
Can he, though?
He was passably fine.
Yes, he gets up and sings a rendition of Frank Sinatra's It Was a Very Good Year.
He's back on his Rat Pack bullshit. This does remind me of a certain ex of mine. That and the fact that, like, she would turn fully Italian when she set foot in an Italian restaurant in the way that Mr. Big does in this episode.
I was going to say, as someone that grew up in an Italian-American household, Frank Sinatra's It Was a Very Good Year was always played during the holidays. And this ex you're referring to really got along with my father and said they were long-lost brothers. So unlike Carrie, was watching this scene less like your heaven and more like your hell as Miranda's currently experiencing across town?
Yeah, she's in some horrendous stand-up comedy situation.
Yes, she's on a date with a man named Alan Miller, a divorced architect. She met at aisle 3 at Food Emporium. Remember Food Emporium?
I love Food Emporium. Is it still there, like the Union Square one? That's the one I used to frequent.
I highly doubt it. I love this line because it just really speaks to the late 90s that they bonded over their shared hatred of, quote, designer croutons.
Who hates designer croutons?
What are designer croutons?
The expensive croutons at Food Emporium. Also, I have been doing a ruthless, and I mean ruthless, closet clean out this week.
I know, you almost threw out some podcasting equipment that I left at your house. I was like, no, we need that.
And one of the greatest things I found was this old Food Emporium tote bag that I've had for years there was a collaboration with Dr. Phil before collab culture was even a thing.
What?
And it says, sometimes I just need to be held. And then has the Dr. Phil logo and the Food Emporium logo.
What does that mean? Like, your food needs to be held in this tote bag?
Well, it's a pun. It's a Carrie Bradshaw-esque pun. Also, Lauren, I feel so bad. I didn't congratulate you on your incredible Dr. Phil impression, which you debuted on last week's episode. It was a delight. I'm so glad the listeners loved it.
People really enjoyed it.
It was scarily accurate.
I think I know what my next Halloween costume is. Get me a bald cap with some sides.
You know what's really, really sad? I actually read Dr. Phil's book about weight loss. And I'm not going to lie, I did lose like 30 pounds. But I think that's also because I like forced myself to not go to the White Castle that was right next to my house all the time. Because when you're like a pothead in your early 20s, like the lure of those chicken burgers.
I feel like you're just inviting me to do my impression. Chelsea, did you imagine Dr. Phil was saying to you, hey, fatty. No, that's bad. That was bad.
That's basically what the book was. No, actually, that's Elizabeth Taylor's diet book.
Stop going to White Castle. Wow, I lost. Guys, in a week, I lost my Dr. Phil impression. Anyway, back to Miranda at the comedy club. This is a bad date. I don't care if it's a first date. It's actually worse if it's a first date. But a second, third date, never go to a comedy club.
Yes, unless you are a fan of the comedian that is performing.
Let's be honest, Miranda and comedy clubs do not mix well together. I am reminded of when Miranda went to see Che work out some material in season 2, and she got absolutely roasted, and Miranda is equally getting roasted at this comedy club.
So her date goes to the bathroom, and his phone starts ringing. So the comic on stage bullies her into picking it up, basically.
I have to give it up to Miranda. I would have, just out of social awkwardness, answered the phone. I do admire her restraint of like, that is this guy's property. I'm not going to answer it. I don't know him like that. But she's bullied into answering the phone anyway and learns that her date has a wife, which she is too shocked to say anything. And the comic, of course, takes the phone out of her hand and blurts out this in front of the entire audience.
This is one of the more humiliating Miranda dates.
And again, we're coming off of the chicken dance. So this is a woman who, I don't know how much time has passed between episodes. Let's say it's even a couple of weeks. But this is a woman that less than a month ago thought she would be marrying the guy staying on her couch. And now she has learned that this great bachelor that she was dating is, as he says, I'm not really divorced, I'm really separated. And then she has the great line, no, we're really separated. See, this is me separating.
It is a great moment for Miranda. And then, of course, she gets, like, heckled by the comic again. Hey, Red, I'll fuck ya.
It should be noted that this episode is written by Daddy MPK, who himself tried stand-up comedy early in his career.
Yeah, our friends actually saw him do stand-up comedy at the Duplex, which is a piano bar in New York that has a little theater attached to it. And they said he was incredible.
He is very funny. This has some of the best dialogue, I think, in season 2. Great episode. And then we get kind of the meat of this episode, which is the girls not at the diner. They are outside at a restaurant that I clocked as Vermouth, which I tried to find the location for this. I could not.
I have never frequented Vermouth.
But as Miranda laments, if they're not married, they're gay, or burned from a divorce, or aliens from the planet don't date me.
Great line.
It just made me realize nothing has changed. And I know that I'm now married, but we've had, Chel, not one, but two fuckettes reach out to us and say that they were broken up with burger style.
Yes, and one was as recent as last week. This poor listener sent us photos of the Post-it. And the sad thing is, it wasn't just one Post-it like burger. It was like 8 Post-its. Like, this motherfucker couldn't just find a piece of paper.
That motherfucker was not concise. We are blasting her information out on the podcast, but I will say we sent her a care package, But you don't know this. Another fuckhead who had bought things during our merch sale, I had to say, oh, that thing you ordered, it's out of stock. Sorry, our bad. And she was like, no problem. I just literally got broken up with on a notes app. And I was like, oh, okay, let me search around. And so I sent her a care package as well.
Wait, notes app? Was it a screenshot? Or was it like a shared note?
I did ask for clarification. Yes, it was a screenshot of a notes app breakup sent to her via text message.
Oh my God. Like, at least do a voice memo.
We're going to be doing an upcoming Love Line episode for Valentine's Day. So fuck ads. If you've got bad breakup stories, please feel free to call into the hotline.
Just keep them on the shorter side or we may not play them.
It's just crazy to think nothing's changed.
So this conversation becomes about urban relationship myths.
It really is one myth. Because it is a partner, usually a man, who's emotionally unavailable for whatever reason, that becomes emotionally available and they get married and live happily ever after.
Right.
There really is no variation of myths.
And of course, Charlotte, ever the optimist, is making the argument that people do change and sometimes things work out, like Carrie and Big. But are they working out? Again, the fact that the chicken dance was the previous episode is troubling.
Yes, but this scene does give us a line that I quote all the time, which is when Miranda says to Charlotte, if you Pollyanna out on me today.
Carrie then is kind of put on the spot to explain how her relationship with Mr. Big is different the second time around. And she says, it just is. I can't explain it. Maybe we just both know that if we came together again, it must be for a reason.
To which I say, no. We discussed this in a recent episode. Carrie is the one who left Big at the end of season one, then ghosts him, then randomly asks him out to dinner 6 months to a year later. In Big's mind, nothing has changed. He's just like, oh, great. She's come back into my life.
Yeah. Then we get maybe the longest, I couldn't help but wonder, in Sex and the City history. I don't know, or at least since we've been doing these rewatches on the pod.
That afternoon, I got to thinking about myths and relationships. Heroes, boyfriends, cyclopses, divorced guys. Are they really that different? The primitive Greeks clung desperately to myths to explain the random hopelessness of their miserable lives. Do modern-day singles need modern-day myths just to help us get through our random and sometimes miserable relationships? And what about Big and Me? After what seemed like an eternity of not quite fitting together, we suddenly fit. Had the relationship God smiled, or was that something I desperately needed to believe? Are we willing to believe anything to date?
See, when I think of I couldn't help but wonder, this is what I'm imagining. Because we've had some very iffy I couldn't help but wonders the past few rewatch episodes.
Yeah.
I think the main crux of Carrie's I couldn't help but wonder and the theme of this episode is, do modern day singles need modern day myths just to help us get through our random and sometimes miserable relationships? Yes.
Yes, some relationships require that you lie to yourself.
Chelsea, are we willing to believe anything to date?
Yeah, if you like someone enough, you have to. It's a necessity.
I was trying to think of what are 2025 urban relationship myths. And I guess it's still the emotionally unavailable partner, usually a guy. I guess it's more the idea that you can turn a situationship into a relationship. I think that's the urban relationship legend of today.
It's that. It's also the fact that people find a way to justify the most outwardly disinterested behavior from men.
You saw me do it for years, yes. I certainly was willing to believe anything to date.
I've definitely been in the relationships where you have to lie to yourself. I'm glad I'm not in one now, but I get it. I completely get it.
So we shift over to Samantha. As Carrie says, while Samantha had little belief in the idea of happily ever after, she had a strong belief in the idea of a smart cocktail at the end of the workday. And she looks behind her, and there's Donald Trump. Samantha, a cosmopolitan, and Donald Trump. Now, I know this is beside the point, Chelsea, but I don't think Donald Trump would be taking lunch meetings to finance his projects at this point in his career. I think people are coming to Trump Tower.
Yeah.
I do wonder if Donald Trump is in this episode because I was looking at the IMDb trivia and I even went into our pink Bible, the Kiss and Tell book, and there's an anecdote where Ed's apartment, the old guy that Samantha dates in this episode, his apartment was actually shot at the Plaza, which Donald Trump owned. And there was a caveat that if you shot at the Plaza, he had to be in whatever you were shooting. That's why he's in Home Alone 2. I couldn't tell where the bar scene was shot, but if it was shot at the Plaza, I wonder if that's why he's in this episode.
Well, the previous episode was shot at the Plaza.
They were just Plaza crazy.
So that would make sense, timing-wise.
So Donald Trump leaves. He's on screen for all of 7 seconds.
Yes, he doesn't even have one line, tragically.
So he's not getting residuals. So at least there's that.
Yeah, he may even be edited out in one of those savage TBS cuts of Sex and the City where they make all the episodes like 15 minutes.
This scene just begins with Ed already at the bar talking to Samantha. So this old guy goes up to Samantha and says, basically, I was so distracted by your beauty, I may have just financed Donald Trump's $150 million project. This is, by the way, a time where he, pre-reality star, he actually did things in real estate still. Because post The Apprentice, the reality show, he just slapped his name on other buildings. What building project could this possibly be? Was Big in on it?
So Ed asks if he can buy her a drink.
To which Samantha says, I already have one. And he replies, can I buy you an island?
Not no.
Yeah. Like, is your name on the deed?
I truly love this Samantha plot line so much.
I have a lot to say about this because one, Ed has a lot of game.
Yeah.
Even his tired lines like, do you come here often? I don't know. It would work on me. As Samantha correctly says, that line is older than you.
Yeah. One of my friends who's in her 40s is currently casually dating a guy in his 80s. And I'm so obsessed with this. I need all of the details. And it does feel very Sex and the City. He's 80, but apparently he's like really fit and also like loves to do coke, which is a little concerning for an octogenarian. But YOLO, I mean, clearly he's made it this far.
Well, your friend needs to get in the will if he's going to continue to casually do cocaine as an octogenarian. But I feel like this perfectly goes into our next conversation, because I imagine your friend has had this conversation that Samantha has with Carrie, which is, what is your age ceiling exactly?
What's your age ceiling with men? 50? Factor in millions and millions of dollars. 50? Well, I just met the cutest older man.
How old? 50? 60? Sweetie, is he on Medicare?
I'm guessing 72. A young 72. Your silence reeks of ageism.
Yeah, that has to be hard to soft launch that you're dating someone who's a part of the AARP. But I will say, I thought that Ed was in his 80s. To hear that he's 72, because my dad is going to be 70 this year, and there's something about the way that a 7-year-old looked in the late 90s compared to now that's quite staggering. Because Ed conveys much older than 72.
Yeah, he does.
Maybe this speaks to growing up in Los Angeles, but I wanted to ask you, Chelsea, have you ever been mistaken for your dad's younger girlfriend?
No, but people think that my wife is my daughter on a fairly regular basis. It most recently happened in the Glossier store.
Wait, it's happened a third time now?
It's happened twice. It happened at an airport, like when we were going through security at the Glossier store. Some chick was like, oh, are you here with your mom to tat? And then she was just so shocked that she was like, she was like, no, that's my sister. And then she was like, oh my God, no, that's my wife. And then just had to run away. Although, wait, no, she couldn't run away because someone was doing her eyebrows. Like, I walked into the store to pick something up and they were like, oh, we're doing like eyebrow like demonstrations today. Do you want your brows done? And we were like, sure.
I thought you were going to say you couldn't leave because, you know, they make you wait. Like you're waiting for a takeout order to get your Glossier goods for those who've never been to a Glossier store before.
In that instance, the way we were dressed did play a major role. Because sometimes Tat does dress like a 10-year-old boy. And I dress, you know, on the more conservative side.
I mean, you should pull a Samantha and just say, your comment reeks of ageism. Well, I have been mistaken for my dad's much younger girlfriend many times, of course, here in Los Angeles. I think the most glaring example of this is many years ago, we were dining at Il Fornaio, and my dad went to the restroom, and the food was being delivered, and the waiter delivered my plate, and he said, here you go. And then he went to go put my father's plate on the table. He said, and here's the dish for your... And I said, father? And he said, sure.
Oh my God. What the fuck? I love that. That's giving, like, sometimes Tad and I go and have drinks at the Bel Air Hotel, like at the bar. And the bar is always packed with, like, these spooky age gap couples, you know, like Beverly Hills, Bel Air age gap couples, like you and your dad, apparently. I think a lot of them are sex workers, though.
When we get to it, I was going to bring up, I think a lot of Ed's problems could just be solved by...
getting a sugar baby.
For sure. I love that for Samantha, the key to his power is the fact that he took her to dinner at John George and they got right in, no reservation required, to which Carrie has the great line, I wasn't aware that John George had an early bird special. If I'm Carrie, the sex columnist who has to write a weekly article, if my friend Samantha tells me that she's dating and going to have sex with a septuagenarian, I'm like, cha-ching, here's this week's article.
Yeah, I'm sending her flowers. I'm like, thank you.
But of course, Carrie's got to carry and questions Samantha and goes, are you telling me that you're seriously capable of having sex with a senior? You better hope she is for next week's column.
Yeah, Samantha is the one that is really in the trenches doing the work.
And Samantha has the great line, you know the saying, all cats look the same in the dark.
I have never heard that saying in my life, only in this Sex and the City episode.
Absolutely not. But this is where Carrie goes in her voiceover. It was pure urban legend. Alligators in the sewer, pets in the microwave, which, I'm sorry, what? Pets in the microwave? What urban legend is this?
Yeah, I don't know that one.
And now an old man and Samantha.
Wait, no, actually, I think that was in the film Urban Legend, so it must be based on a real one.
And the movie Urban Legend would have come out a year before, so maybe that's what it's a reference to.
Spoiler alert, Rebecca Gayhart was the murderer.
Wow, Chelsea. Wow.
The Noxzema bitch was out to get everyone.
Chelsea, that was next on my watch list. How could you? I'm sorry, are we supposed to understand that this is the first time that Samantha has slept with a significantly older man? Because I don't buy it.
Yeah, I don't buy it either.
We're continuing the trend of Big being an excellent hang and very pro-Italian-American. Is Big Italian-American? James John Preston? John James Preston.
Well, he went to a Catholic church, right? So maybe.
Or he's just really gotten into The Sopranos. Either way, he's gotten an excellent piece of veal.
He's gotten a piece of veal, and Carrie uses this moment in the kitchen to ask him to make an effort to spend time with her friends.
Well, she has this crazy voiceover because we have to connect the through line of urban legends and Greek mythology, because she goes, in every myth there comes a point when the mere mortals are given a test. The way they respond usually determines whether they find paradise or are tied to a rock for all eternity. Girl, you're just asking him to hang out with your friends.
I know, again, the bar for him is so low.
I love that Big's assertion that he knows her friends enough. He's like, Charlotte's the brunette, Miranda's the redhead, and Samantha is trouble.
Samantha's the one who tried to fuck me?
And you want me to hang out with her? Strange move, kid. By the way, weren't we all just at a wedding together like a month ago?
Well, he was on his phone the whole time.
So Carrie wants them to all have dinner Saturday night at Denial.
Top tier fake club name.
So good.
It's up there with Trade. And of course, Bed, weirdly, turned out to not be a fictional club.
Yes, but it works with the theme of this episode, because Carrie goes, apparently everyone in Manhattan wanted to be in denial. So he, I would say, reluctantly agrees. He gives her an okay.
Then she gets a call from Miranda, who she was supposed to have dinner with, but because Mr. Big had this incredibly seductive veal, but she canceled by leaving a voicemail on Miranda's answering machine.
So Chelsea, IMDb trivia notes that this is the first time we see Carrie with a cell phone, which is funny because in later episodes, like in season 4, she doesn't have a cell phone. Because during her ill-fated 35th birthday, when Carrie returns home and plays her own answering machine, Miranda yells at her to get a cell phone.
Right.
After the second big breakup, she must have thrown that cell phone straight through Fifth Avenue and it broke in a million pieces.
I could see her doing it in the fountain in Central Park.
I will say that the genuine concern that Cynthia Nixon has when she says the line, "Is everything all right?" really makes me side with Miranda.
Of course.
Because this is a bullshit move on Carrie's part. And a shining example of why, when people say that Carrie is a bad friend, why she is a bad friend.
Because as Miranda said, you blew me off for a piece of politically incorrect meat.
Also, I've always wondered, why this bar? Miranda says that they're going for dinner. So was this bar by Miranda's work? Did Carrie tell her to go to meet her for a drink before dinner at this bar? Because Miranda has clearly never been to this place before because she's never seen Steve. Just curious. Doesn't seem like a bar either one of these women would frequent. So rightfully, Miranda is pissed off at Carrie and she says, you know what? Your relationship is exactly the same as always. It's all about him. And then ends with, enjoy your veal. And Big, because he actually isn't as emotionally constipated as Carrie would like us to think, asks, is there a problem? And Carrie lies and is like, no, everything's fine. But I would be like, oh, if this were you and me, I'd be like, oh, Chell's mad at me because she feels like I blew her off.
Right, that's what a sane person would do.
Okay, I just wanted to check in with that.
No, that is bizarre behavior.
Because it's not like Big would hear that if she told the truth and be like, oh, kid, go to the bar and meet Miranda. You'd be like, oh, that sucks.
Well, you would just be honest and be like, oh, I fully canceled on her at the last minute because I just couldn't be fucked to go. Anyway, back at the bar, we meet Steve. And I forgot that Miranda and Steve have a very sort of like baby girl dynamic in this first interaction.
Because he's giving her a little bit of shit.
He's demanding that she respect him, despite the fact that he is a lowly service worker.
Well, his first words to Miranda are please. Because he's saying to her, you know, can you ask me for another glass of wine, please?
And then he brings her a glass of milk.
No, he brings her a glass of Cote de Rhone, which please drink that slowly, unlike Nicole Kidman, who really slams down that milk.
So it becomes obvious that Steve has been listening to her conversation with Carrie, and he's like, who was that? Boyfriend? Girlfriend? Butcher?
So for the Miranda that the audience knows, this interaction is very cute. But if someone spoke to me in this way and they didn't know me at all, this would be a dick move. But because we know Miranda and the way she is.
Yes, and because we now know Steve.
Steve's handling of Miranda is incredibly charming and frankly, hot.
It is hot. He should have never stopped acting like this. Like, he got progressively less assertive throughout the course of the series and the films.
Well, Chelsea, this episode made me realize I think there was a concerted effort to dumb Steve down from this moment.
No, it's so true. Because Steve was even, like, reading a book.
Which he jokes as The Joy of Bartending by Hemingway. But Steve is reading a Hemingway book. It's the complete short stories of Ernest Hemingway.
So this happens, and then the next time that we see Steve read, I think he's reading a book about aquariums.
This is especially curious because if you read the Kiss and Tell book, the writers explain that David Eigenberg, who plays Steve, read for a bunch of other Boyfriend of the Week roles, and they were so charmed by him that they basically wrote Steve for him.
Yeah, because as I recall, Jenny Bix had a bit of a crush on him.
And according to Jenny Bix, she herself was in a very Miranda Steve-esque relationship at the time.
Cute.
So he gives her a nice glass of wine as a bribe so that she will hang out and talk to him, or else he'll be left with the NYU students who are drinking Amstel Light and discussing Fiona Apple.
Okay, at least NYU kids are smart for the most part.
Yeah, imagine what deranged conversations NYU students are having now. I would love to overhear a conversation about Fiona Apple.
Also, it makes sense that they would like Fiona Apple because, like, they are kind of depressed. Like, you can't fully open a window in NYU, if you know what I'm saying.
Oh, the suicide-proof windows, you mean?
The suicide-proof everything. Like, you know what they had to do to their library? It's crazy.
On to happier things, which is Miranda goes home with Steve, and he serves Miranda 2 orgasms straight up.
Goddess bless.
I've always wondered this. I've never gone home with a bartender myself, especially a New York bartender, because did she just stick around till 4 a.m, or did Steve close the bar early?
We'll never know. After they fuck, Steve's like, can I get your number? And Miranda's like, why?
Why do you think, Miranda? He wants to see you again.
At the very least, he wants to fuck you again, and why not?
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of crazy. I understand the point that they're making in this storyline, that she is just so jaded. She can't let anyone in. But if he gave you 2 orgasms the first time you've had sex, why not give him your phone number? Have a good time.
Meanwhile, across town, Samantha's having a date with Ed.
So they are at Ed's apartment. They have had 3 dinners, 2 extravagant lunches later. This is very un-Samantha not to sleep with someone on the first date. I guess she wanted to see how many Michelin star restaurants Ed would take her to.
And Ed is, like, very straight up with her, you know? He's like, I only have 10 good years left, 10, 12. I just want to have fun.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see what the problem is. Also, at this dinner, Ed gives her a bunch of diamond jewelry, which I don't know if you clock the housekeeper's face.
Yeah.
But clearly Ed has done this once or twice before because this housekeeper rolls her eyes. He's also served Samantha what Carrie says in the voiceover is an impressive 6-course dinner. Does Ed expect Samantha to have sex with him? Because a 6-course dinner followed by sex usually doesn't equate for me.
Yeah, no, that's disgusting.
I mean, Samantha is a stronger person than me. I get it. The diamond jewelry is very exciting, but the way that Ed shimmies over to her would instantly give me the ick. I don't even need to see his ass. I'd be like,
I don't know. I'm a fan. I feel like he's one of the nicer boyfriends on this show.
Well, yeah, he's seen a thing or two.
He also communicates very openly, which we don't get from a ton of Sex and the City boyfriends.
So as Carrie says, this is Samantha's own urban relationship myth. The woman who stopped for a cocktail after work and lived happily ever after for 10 to 12 years tops. Because that's what Ed is proposing to her of like, I get it. I'm old. Why don't we have a deal where you're just with me until I pass off this mortal coil? But I was thinking about it. 10 to 12 years from 1999, Ed seemingly is some kind of financing guy. Who's to say if Samantha did take him up on this offer that Ed wouldn't have lost all of his money during the financial crisis?
So she fucks Ed, or does she fuck Ed?
Well, there's also this interesting thing that goes back to the title of the episode, which is, he's like, don't worry, I've got a big pocket of Viagra. And then he puts her hand on his dick that's presumably hard. And she's like, oh, that's not Viagra. Are we saying that Ed took Viagra at the beginning of this dinner?
I guess.
Again, it was very of the time. I feel like Viagra has fallen out of the pop culture zeitgeist. But the late 90s, this was high time for old men being able to have sex again.
Yeah, true.
They're fooling around, let's say, in the dark, because according to Samantha, dark is better. Samantha realizes that in the dark, it's all the same. Ed's lips were not the lips of an older man. Ed's touch was not the touch of an older man. But then Ed has to go to the bathroom.
Or the little boy's room.
That would also have given me the ick. I would have been out there before I ever saw Ed's ass.
See, I do say the little girl's room because it's so disgusting.
But not in a sexual context.
No, of course.
Samantha witnesses Ed's flabby ass, which the other IMDb trivia is that this is not that actor's butt, but a flabby butt double. So Samantha runs off. She says it was a reaction to the shellfish, but the housekeeper has Samantha's purse and jacket waiting, which makes it seem like Ed has done this routine several times for this to be the ultimate reaction.
God, it's so sad that he didn't live to see Seeking Arrangement.
But this is my point, Chelsea. For what Ed is looking for, there are many a sex worker who would happily oblige.
Head down to the Bel Air Hotel and find them.
Anyway, fast forward to Saturday afternoon. Miranda's at home and Steve comes a-knocking. Or I guess Steve comes a-buzzing. Is Steve showing up at a woman he hooked up with home once charming or creepy?
Charming. Come on, it's Steve. It's me, Steve. Worst Steve impression. Second worst. No, well, also, sometimes you had to physically show up in person back in the day. There weren't as many communication avenues, and as established, she refused to give him her phone number, so.
And he does leave that night, and he's like, stop by the bar sometime, which she clearly doesn't, so he has to take matters into his own hands. So she lets him up. And instead of understandably presuming that he just wants to see her again, she's like, did you forget something? No, he wants to take you out on a date. Miranda, come on.
So she reluctantly agrees to have a drink with him at Denial.
Well, she's such a bitch about this. He's like, I didn't have your number and I wanted to tell you something. I like you. Which is very sweet. And she just goes, translation, I think you're an easy lay and I'd like to have sex again. And he's like, no, have dinner with me. So he's like, what about Saturday night? And she's like, I have plans. This is very charming, very cute. He's like, quick, before you can make something else up. And she's like, I really do. I'm having drinks with my friend at Denial at 7. Miranda did not think, bartender, he might know the bartender at Denial, which Steve, of course, does. And I think this move is so hot. He's like, okay, see you at 7. She closes the door. And then before she can close it, he knocks again. And he goes, when are you really meeting your friends? And she reluctantly goes, 9.
Such a bitch.
He caught her ass. This is what Miranda needs.
Someone smart and intuitive, yes.
And calls her on her bullshit in a way that is charming and not like that lawyer that was mean that ultimately gives her chlamydia in 3.
Cut to Big's apartment.
Can we discuss this Carrie outfit?
Sure.
Odd choice.
Yeah, it was. I agree.
This is a really strong episode, but I have to say, it doesn't score that high on the fashion scale. Not a lot of memorable outfits. And this Carrie outfit of, it's not a really a metallic dress. It's like a bronzy
polyester. It looks cheap for sure. I mean, she's hot, but not my fave.
And she also has brought a poncho as well as her outerwear of choice, which I guess is very Carrie, but like an odd combination. I'm sorry, Patricia Field, but these two random items did not work well together.
And Big is basically just like, actually, I don't want to go, or do you mind if I sit this one out?
Well, she should have gotten that memo when he opens the door and he's in slides, boxers, and his button down, which I have to say he actually looks quite chic. Now this would just be like a Justin Bieber, Pete Davidson look, actually.
But when he says, do you mind if I stay home tonight? Her response is like, no, sure, stay home. It's like, what?
And then in her voiceover, she was like, I was afraid if I looked him into his eyes, I'd turn to stone. Communicate your needs.
Yeah, be like, actually, this is really important to me, and I am now upset that you've done this at the last possible minute, which is profoundly disrespectful.
I imagine in her head, she's like, ah, I now see how Miranda feels. This sucks when someone cancels on you last minute.
Yeah, that's karma.
So she is irate in her voiceover on the walkover to Denial. She says, how could I have let myself believe things would be different the second time around? I've never heard of a myth in which a self-centered 42-year-old baby magically transforms into a grown man that you could bring out in public. Okay. He's been working all day. As he says, it's going to rain. He doesn't demand. He doesn't say I'm not coming out. He goes, do you mind if I don't go? And you said, sure. So at Denial, all the girls are there. And I think it's Charlotte who says they won't see us until our party is here. We discussed on Carrie's 35th birthday episode, the ill-fated Il Cantinori dinner, that we believe that Carrie was the reason that no one could be seated until your entire party is there, because she is seated alone at a table for 11 for hours. This remains my belief. Carrie is the one who has impeded us from being able to sit at our table while we wait for our friends to come. She's continuously trying to get a table for more people that are ever going to show up at any one time to dinner.
So she's not honest with the girls when she gets there.
As she says in her voiceover, I figure as long as I was in denial, I might as well stay there. All right, girl. I always forget when watching this episode that Steve is already there because he appears with a tray of drinks.
Okay, which is weird. So it's like, okay, now he's working at this bar? That's confusing.
Well, you want to talk about emotional availability. Carrie has been dating Big again for who knows how long, certainly months at this point. Can't even get him to show up to hang out with her friends. Steve, who slept with this woman once a few days ago, is down to meet the friends. But of course, Miranda can't let him have this, right?
No, and she makes a really cruel joke in front of her friends.
Right. Steve says, if you want good service, send a bartender. And then Miranda goes, if you want a good fuck, go home with one. And even Samantha has a look like, honey, not the move.
So rude.
You know what? Actually, good thing Big isn't there. Terrible vibes at this table.
Yeah, for sure. So Steve's like, excuse me, can we talk for a moment? Because he's just been humiliated in front of her friends. And we get a full-ass rom-com speech.
Thank you. One quick question and I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. Why do you hate guys so much?
Excuse me?
We just met, so I know that ain't all about me. Wait, wait, wait!
What? What do you want?
I just want to get to know you better. Do me a favor. Can you for one second believe that maybe I'm not some full of shit guy? That maybe I do like you? That maybe the other night was special? Do you think that maybe you can believe that?
No. Maybe I've just slept with too many bartenders.
Poor guy. He really laid his cards out on the table.
And it's stuff like this that makes me feel like Daddy MPK has gaslit us. Because I am fine with the end just like that rebranding of Miranda as a lesbian and her and Steve's relationship ran its course. But this whole thing that they never had any chemistry or she lowered herself to be with him, I will not stand for that erasure. They have amazing chemistry. Steve clocks Miranda on her bullshit, which is what she needs, okay? He pushes back on her in a healthy way. And I get it. Might there be someone better for Miranda? Possibly, but we've never seen it on the show. This is her healthiest relationship.
For sure. So Miranda goes back to the table in an even fouler mood. And then she's like, Big isn't coming, is he?
Men are shit. I mean, at that point, if my friend was bringing this bad of vibes, I know Samantha's a great friend, but I really feel like Samantha should have just stood up and be like, I have an old man to have sex with. Seeing his flabby ass is better than being at this table right now.
And then miraculously, in the nick of time, Big shows up.
Thank God, Chelsea, because Carrie did not have the heart to tell Charlotte that happily ever after really is just a myth. And then we get this insane slow-mo, a Big running down the stairs, Carrie's head spinning to see him, and them embracing.
Again, the bar is so low for Mr. Big that him showing up to a dinner that he's previously agreed to attend is seen as heroic behavior.
But Chelsea, it's clearly already started to rain. He had to hail a cab. I don't think Raul was on the clock. So seeing Big show up, as Carrie says in her voiceover, shook Miranda's lack of belief system to its very core. And so she's like, I'm out. Do you think Big was like, hey, you wanted me to meet all of your friends and then the redhead leaves?
She chases Steve, who's sadly walking alone in the rain.
Well, we get a great, and just like that, Miranda left denial. She goes straight into Steve's arms and they make out.
She also says, Steve, maybe I can believe it. which is as close to a rom-com as we've gotten with Miranda on the series.
I guess I'm incorrect, right? Earlier in the episode, I was talking about how there's only one relationship myth. I guess Carrie, in her ending voiceover, speaks of another relationship myth. From that night on, promiscuous women everywhere would tell the tale of the one-night stand that turned into a relationship.
Big asks Samantha if she's fucked the old guy.
Which is clearly in Carrie's column, but I like this idea that we really never see that Carrie is gossiping about her girlfriends to Big.
Yeah.
And then the last lines of the episode are, "As for Big and me, that was the night we stopped being a myth and started becoming real." Which kind of sounds like the real world slogan, right? What was it? What happens when people stop being polite and start getting real?
What happens when men stop being cyclopses? And yeah, maybe not the strongest line to end on, but whatever. This is a great episode. How many Manolos are we giving it?
Gotta demote one for Donald Trump being in it, but I'm gonna say 9 Manolos.
Yeah, I'm giving it 9 too. Because we love Samantha with the old guy. We love the introduction of Steve. Also, Big singing Sinatra. Very important.
It was a good Sex and the City men episode.
Yeah, the men really delivered.
Shall we do the exit survey?
Who is the MVP for you?
Steve!
Of course.
He came in, laid pipe, didn't stand for any of Miranda's guff, and he had some solid jokes.
David Eigenberg showed a lot of range,
which the writers would systematically strip away for him in the coming several decades.
Yes, until he's pussy-whipped beyond recognition.
Who are we voting off the island of Manhattan? I feel like this is fairly obvious.
Yeah, obviously Trump. Bad vibe.
Who is the best dressed? This isn't a fashion heavy hitter episode.
Yeah.
It's definitely not Carrie's look at denial. So maybe that lilac dress she wears while Big is making the veal?
She also wore that tank top with a cupcake on it. I'm still giving it to Carrie just because it was at the very least more memorable than what the other characters were wearing.
For sure.
Best line.
You blew me off for a piece of politically incorrect meat.
See, I'm going with, if you leave, I'll have to listen to those NYU kids with the Amstel lights discuss Fiona Apple.
Okay. But it's in the Steve and Miranda scene.
Yeah.
Who are you?
Miranda, I guess.
I was going to say, I bitched about her attitude all episode, but honestly, I'm Miranda. I've definitely been this jagged at many points in my dating life.
Yeah.
What is your biggest trigger?
Trump, obviously.
Oh, I was going to say maybe how old and gross 72-year-olds are considered now that my parents are around that age.
Okay, hottest take.
I've talked a lot about Steve and Miranda. I'm sure you're going to think my take is that Steve and Miranda are endgame and how dare Daddy MPK sully their relationship. But alas, that's not a hot take. So my hot take is Steve should have never bothered with Miranda. He should have heated off her standoffish nature and gone home with one of the NYU students talking about Fiona Apple while drinking Amstel Light.
See, my hot take is that sometimes you have to fuck the elderly. You know? It's a great way to give back to previous generations. Also, older generations, they have more time to improve their technique and they have a better understanding of culture. Like, they actually want to talk to me about Liza Minnelli.
So is it cheating if they're an octogenarian? Paul, I'm giving back. It's not cheating. I'm giving back to the community. You have to understand.
That's my hot take.
That's a pretty hot take. All right, that does it for us.
This was fun.
This was super fun.
Anyway, we will be back next week and hopefully we will have watched some of the Oscar-nominated films.
Absolutely. And as I hinted earlier in the episode, we are going to be doing a Loveline Hotline episode for Valentine's Day. So if you have love questions, embarrassing romances, terrible breakups, feel free to call the hotline at 323-486-6773.
See you next week.
See you next week, guys. Bye.